This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow with WNYC from the Green Space in New York City. It has been an exciting and hectic year in science discovery and innovation. We've reported on stories from across the fields of science, from urban climate plans to panda conservation, from AI energy consumption to the spread of bird flu, from ancient bird brains to what's going on in your gut. And with us now are three scientific experts and researchers here to reflect on the most exciting discoveries in their fields, the important stories you might have missed, and tell us what they're looking forward to in 2025. So please welcome my guest, Dr. Celine Gounder, internationally renowned internist, infectious disease specialist, and epidemiologist. She is the senior fellow and editor-at-large for public health at KFF Health News. Welcome back to the show. Dr. Jackie Faraday, astrophysicist at the famous American Museum of Natural History, just up the road a piece, working to characterize the atmospheres of worlds beyond our solar system. She also creates immersive public programs in the museum's planetarium. Welcome to the program. And Professor Kevin Reed, chief climate scientist at the New York Climate Exchange, where he leads the strategic direction of research programs and Associate Provost for Climate and Sustainability Programming at Stony Brook University out there in Long Island. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Celine, let me begin with you. What do you think is the biggest news story out of public health from this year?
So this series of papers from the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation published in The Lancet just a couple weeks ago looks at what's called the Human Development Index, which is a composite of health, income, and education, and looked at where do we stand in this country based on demographics and generation. And the finding that I thought was most striking, which I think also feeds into this moment politically, was that if you take people 75 and older, you take the top decile, again, in terms of health, income, education, that top decile of the over 75 is 50% white men, 35% white women, and then a mix. And then you go down to people under 40. Again, you take that top 10% in terms of health, income, and education, you go from 50% white men in that oldest age group to 5% white men in that youngest age group. And that matters because it's not just your status in terms of Human Development Index that matters. It's also change in status that really impacts the way people look at things and think about things. And so we are seeing a number of different trends in terms of opioid overdose, suicide, gun violence. All of this is related to some of these changes in status. This also relates to economic situations, what's happened with manufacturing, globalization, automation, loss of jobs. And by the way, that is a tiny preview of what is to come with AI. We have not prepared for that at all. And this is having very real health consequences across the country.
In what way?
Well, again, we've seen what are called the diseases of despair rise over the past decade plus. So a huge increase in suicides, a huge increase of drug overdose, and deaths from gun violence. And there are some solutions that are being proposed. One I just would highlight for your audience, there's a guy by the name of Richard Reeves who's really focused on this issue of what's happening to men in our society. And as a woman who's interested in women's health, I also understand that we cannot fight for women's health and expect to have achieve equity and the progress we want if you're leaving men behind. And so this Richard Reeves, I would highly recommend his book, Boys and Men. But some of the recommendations he has with respect to education is to actually redshirt boys by a year or two because of their maturity level and ability to learn. The idea being that they will be better students if given a little bit more time, start a year or two later than girls. The other is to encourage more men to take jobs in what's called the pink industry. So health and education. And these are areas that are less susceptible to automation, AI. These are jobs that we will be needing more and more into the future, especially in the health sector. And this benefits women because when you have an industry that is more balanced in terms of gender representation, you have less ghettoization. Women's status also goes up commensurately. So those are just some of the examples. Yeah. And this has impacts in terms of health.
Wow. Thanks, Celine. This is really interesting news. I'm not sure it's great news. We're going to come back to talk more about public health soon, but let's shift for a bit. Look at the skies. Jackie, there was lots of exciting news about the moon and Mars this year, right? But your research goes a little bit further away from home. What's your top news story from this year from the world of astrophysics?
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and take us off of Earth right now.
I'm ready.
As we discussed, because I think that's good for all of us right now. And the reason for that is because that's also what I study. But in thinking of like top stories, one of the things I just want to tell people is that there's a telescope and it's called the James Webb Space Telescope. Everybody know it? Yes? Yeah, it's a good one. It looks at the sky in infrared wavelengths. That's not something that your eye is attuned to. So what I would say, what's happening in 2024, so the telescope was launched in 2020, Christmas Day 2020. And then it took a while for it to get there, and it took a while for us to start calibrating. So really, by 2024, we're starting to see some really good results. And one of the ones I was going to highlight for you is actually one that I led, and I think it represents one of these things where, like, you can look up and you get a wavelength coverage that you've never seen, and you can discover something that no one's ever seen before. And what we did was we turned the telescope to an object with a name that's not going to excite you. It's WISE 1935. I'm sorry, it doesn't have a better name. And what we saw when we looked at it, we used one of the instruments on JWST. We put the light through what's called a spectrograph. You break the light up, you see what the atmosphere is made of. And what we saw was some of the stuff we expected. You see some ammonia, you see some water in vapor form, you see carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide, and then we saw something we had not seen before in another object. We saw methane gas, which you do see in a lot of things, but you usually see it absorbing, but we did not see it absorbing. We saw it in emission. So it was glowing. And that had not been seen outside of the solar system before. And we had to come up with an explanation for what it might be. And what we did is we turned to the solar system to try and help us explain this. And we looked at Jupiter, and Jupiter has this happening on it. Jupiter has it for a reason that's actually another story of 2024, which is something you all might have seen this year, which is something called an aurora, the Northern Lights or the Southern Lights. And what we saw was what we theorize, because we can't know for sure, but we think that actually the phenomenon that we were seeing, shown by the James Webb Space Telescope, is an object light years away from you with a phenomenon that's akin to what you might see here. But the other zipper of this is that the reason why the planets in our solar system get the aurora is we have the sun, which gives off this beautiful amount of energy and light. That's why we're all here and happy. And then it also slams us with electromagnetic radiation that trickles down from our magnetic field, and you get the light up. So that's what causes our aurora. Jupiter has a special other aurora, and it is caused by its active volcanic moon called Io. Io is volcanic. It spews out a plasma, it gets trapped with Jupiter. The object that we discovered, this phenomenon happening, is isolated. It has no parent star. So the phenomenon also pointed us to the idea that maybe we were actually seeing an interaction from a moon that was orbiting it.
What was the object? Do we know what it was?
Yeah, itself? I would say it was actually discovered by a citizen scientist, by a regular person that worked on a program that that I co-founded. It's called Backyard World : Planet 9. I encourage anybody listening or here to join the program, because the one thing that's amazing about science is that anybody can and should do it, and you can join any of these citizen science projects. It's a very low-mass object. It's about 20 times the mass of Jupiter, light years away from
me. Is it a brown dwarf?
Yes. Sorry, Ira. Yes.
I was trying to get you
to the water.
Say that.
I know. Yes, it's a brown dwarf. It's an object in between a star and a planet. It's got properties of both. Doesn't have enough mass for hydrogen fusion in it. So it's just cooling for its life.
So that's what the surprising part is, part of it, is that it's glowing instead of
Yes, it's
dying?
Glowing. And the glowing is not something it can do on its own. It cannot ignite that methane. It's happening in the upper atmosphere of the object. It could be a new phenomenon in physics that we haven't figured out on one of these objects. I don't want to just say we found a moon. I always say this. I'm not saying we found a moon. But I'm kind of saying maybe we need a moon to actually see so it can send the plasma over to the object.
Tell us about Dan Castledon and Backyard World. Is that part?
Yeah, so Dan Castledon is the citizen scientist that worked with us that discovered the object. And he discovered it, honestly, so Backyard World's colon Planet 9. Initially, what we were trying to actually do is do the same method that discovered Pluto, which is you take images of the sky taken with a time baseline in between them, and you blink them. It's called, get ready for it, the blink method. So it's called the blink method. And so you just blink images, and if you see an object jump, then it may be telling you that you found something really good. Now, you can use AI, machine learning, and we do that as well. But actually, the human eye, believe it or not, is phenomenal at this. It's really good at pattern recognition, and it can get through stuff that AI, frankly, we can have lots of conversations about it, but it's not as great at. Dan found it, sent it to us. And we then followed it up with, I led a James Webb Space Telescope proposal. Dan is a member of our James Webb team.
Wow.
Yeah. You could also be on a James Webb proposal.
I'm happy to join. Where do you go from here with the knowledge you have now? Is there another step you can do in the discovery?
So the fact that it's there really opens the doors. We didn't realize we could look for this before. It's also, I'll tell you one thing that's important that astronomers are trying to do with the James Webb Space Telescope. One of the things we'd really love to do is discover something we haven't seen before, a molecule that we've never seen before. But then you can arrange all of your proposals around going after it. So I, in setting up this observation, I had not arranged to look for that particular area. I didn't get enough signal in there. I didn't know it was going to happen. Do you know what I'm saying? Like sometimes you need to see it so that then the next round we can prioritize that kind of observation. And all my colleagues now are all up on it. So now we're thinking very carefully about how you can find aurora spectroscopically like this.
Well, you'll come back and tell us more when you do find it.
100%.
Okay. We need to take a break, but we'll be back with more from our year in review celebration held earlier this month at WNYC's Green Space in New York. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you're just joining us, it's our year in review event held earlier this month at WNYC's Green Space in New York City with public health expert Celine Gounder, astrophysicist Jackie Faherty, and climate scientist Kevin Reed. I asked Dr. Reed for his thoughts on the biggest news in climate this year. Kevin, let's shift back to our planet for a moment. Your work has you working with teams of researchers studying our climate, as well as in collaboration with communities most directly affected by climate change. I'm almost afraid to ask this. What is the state of climate change as we end up 2024?
Well, let's start with the bad news, Ira, which is every year at the beginning of the year, most people are thinking about their resolutions. And as a climate scientist, we're looking back at the previous year and we're saying, how much worse did it get? Right. And so let's start with the fact that 2023, we learned earlier this year, was the hottest year on record. And 2024 is on pace to beat that. And what we've learned, actually, through some reports that have come out of New York State, so there's been the New York State Impacts Assessment. There's also been the New York Panel on Climate Change, which is focused right here in the city. And we're seeing that it's not just temperature that's changing, right? It's precipitation. So in New York, annual precipitation has increased by 10 to 20% since 1900. And it certainly doesn't feel like that when you go through a fall in which you've been in a drought, right? But that's actually a telltale sign of climate change as well, that you teeter-totter between those extremes. But it's really just not this general increase in precipitation. It's what we see on social media. It's what you see in the news, right? Which is every time there's a rainfall event in New York City, we've all seen images of the subway flooding at some point, right? Water rushing down the stairs. And this is really, again, a telltale sign that climate change is here and it's starting to impact our weather. Out where I teach at Stony Brook University, we actually have two dorms that are actually out of service this year because as students were moving in August is when we experienced almost 10 inches of rain. And there are communities right here on Long Island out there that have changed to the point where the ponds that have been there, the dams that have been there are gone, and they're not coming back, right? And so these are people's livelihoods and cultures that are changing. And that's just New York. I mean, when you look at the world, these signs are everywhere. Changes in extreme heat, changes in drought, And it's really, really starting to impact society. But let's go to some good news really quick.
Please.
Okay, so some good news that we learned this year is that, yeah, one of the other impacts of climate change that we often hear about is the destruction of coral reefs, right? So there's been some in a study earlier this year that actually showed that, you know, some parts of coral reefs might be a little bit more resilient, right? So it might not be as bleak as we thought. So there won't be complete devastation. And that at least suggests, right, from a biodiversity standpoint, that there's still a chance.
That is some good news.
Yeah, that's some good news. Another good news is that you can look, you know, around our local waterways right here in the New York area out on Long Island. And we've shown that actually through targeted efforts of trying to revamp, let's say, for example, the Shinnecock Bay out on Long Island, you can actually do this through restoring shellfish. And it can actually clean up the water that has been impacted both by fertilizer but also by climate change.
Yeah, we actually did a story on that.
And I think for me, the most exciting news is actually just this year, the state of New York hooked up its first utility scale offshore wind farm just off of Long Island. And now we actually receive about 130 megawatts.
Wow.
Of energy from clean, renewable wind from offshore. So what does that mean? That's about 70,000 homes that can be powered by offshore wind. And that's just a drop in the bucket in which New York is hoping to get to, which is about 9 gigawatts, right, by 2035. So that's, you know, almost a 100-time increase in we'll getting that clean energy.
This is becoming cheaper and cheaper, isn't it? It's not just trying to become greener, but it's also economically the right way to go.
That's right. So right now, solar and onshore wind are the cheapest forms of electricity. If you want to develop a new electricity power plant right now, the cheapest way to do it is through onshore wind or solar. And it's cheaper than coal, it's cheaper than natural gas, and it's cheaper than nuclear energy.
Well, and how do you think the change in administration, the new Trump administration, will affect these climate change mitigation efforts?
So we're sticking with the good news, right? Look, I just talked a little bit about that, the momentum, right? That over the last 10 years, we've doubled renewable energy in this country. States like New York, which are leading through its Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, aren't turning back. Companies aren't turning back. They're making guarantees that they're going to be trying to go to net zero by certain dates. Their shareholders expect it. They're going to start to continue this momentum. And so in that sense, right, once you start rolling, it's going to be hard to stop, especially when it's the cheapest form of energy there is. And so what it just means is that under, you know, in the next 4 years, so that's the important thing to note, right, that administrations come and go. And that climate change is a local challenge, right? Adaptation and resilience happens at the local level. And so it just means that there'll be more leadership occurring at the places like the city of New York and cities around us, and that's where the leadership will be for the next 4 years. And so we should really turn to those experts and those leaders and empower them to do that.
But we've heard and we've seen some talk and action also about returning to nuclear power. I'm saying Microsoft just announced they're going to buy power from the one reactor at Three Mile Island that's going to be coming back online. Is nuclear a viable option with these smaller, cheaper, supposedly safer little reactors?
So let's start with the basics, right? So 20% of the electricity in the United States comes from nuclear, and it's been that way since the early 90s. Nuclear energy has been an important component of our electricity generation in the United States, as well as is globally and in other nations. In terms of going back to what I said a few minutes ago, it still remains solar and wind are still cheaper than a nuclear power plant. They're actually quicker, right? You can build them sooner.
Right.
The typical timeline is at least 6 years for even these smaller reactors because it's new technology. And the nice thing about the clean forms of energy, like renewable, is they don't require a fuel, right, which is a cost which also has sustainability efforts in the long run. And, you know, I want to actually take this an opportunity to talk about another good news story that I saw that came out this year from the University of Tennessee, which was around one of the things of why we're talking about nuclear and bringing it back as well. Offshore wind and solar, these are intermittent, right? What happens when the sun doesn't shine? Well, we figured that out. It's called batteries, by the way. But the aspect of that is that it's not as impactful on the grid as you think, right? And so the other worry is, oh, well, what happens when there's a storm? We're going to lose power. Well, they've actually done the study. They've looked at the data and they've done the modeling. And it turns out that if you have a grid that's completely reliant on renewable energy, it doesn't have any more power outages than one that's focused on a coal source, for example.
Right. Celine, let's get back to you talking about another story in public health I want to highlight, and that is bird flu. H5N1, spreading worldwide. There are outbreaks in poultry and dairy cows here in the U.S. Should we, is something to worry about?
Well, we're coming up on 5 years since COVID, right? Have we learned the lessons?
Uh-oh.
No, we haven't. So we first saw H5N1 bird flu among wild birds, then poultry, huge number of other mammals. Then this year was reported that we now saw infections among dairy cattle. In the poultry industry, H5N1 is deadly to poultry, so they just cull all the birds when they have an infection. And we've actually had over 100 million birds culled as a result of H5N1. And by the way, that's why your eggs are so expensive. It's not inflation. Then you have now infections in the dairy cattle industry, where it's not deadly to cattle, but it is being transmitted through the milk. And we are concerned that it may be reducing milk production, so you have that piece. There's a lot of industry pushback against testing, because if they have a positive test, what does that mean in terms of their ability to move cattle, to sell their milk? They may have to dispose of that. There are huge economic losses. The USDA announced a program earlier this year to compensate cattle farmers if they do have infections on their farms. There's been very little uptake, probably because they still don't see the compensation as outweighing the risks involved to them financially. And meanwhile, we're continuing to see infections transmitted from poultry to workers, as well as from dairy cattle to farm workers. And this is dangerous because you're creating a situation where you're more likely to see the virus evolve to better infect humans. In fact, in the journal Science was reported that researchers have found that a single mutation, a switch in a receptor called the sialic acid receptor, going from a 2-3 to a 2-6, for those who are steeped in the virology, will cause the virus to adapt from being really tailored to infect birds. Also for the eyes, which is why we've been seeing a lot of these eye infections in humans. But with that one-point mutation, it becomes then more infectious to our lungs, which is where you get pneumonia, kind of like what we saw with COVID in the early days. There was a case in British Columbia recently of a teen who was infected with a form of H5N1 that did go into the lungs. He was in the ICU, hospitalized for weeks as a result of this.
What's the lesson we didn't learn that you were hinting at from COVID?
Remember too much testing?
We should be doing more.
We should be doing a lot of testing. That is how you have like radar and a sense of what's happening. You're seeing how the virus is evolving. So we're not doing enough testing in the dairy industry because of the industry fears of huge financial losses. We're not doing enough testing among the farm workers. So if a farm worker on a farm tests positive, that means cattle or poultry probably have it too. The farm workers don't want to get tested because many of them are here as undocumented immigrants or have family members who are, and we're having a huge issue or a huge politicization of immigration right now. These are people who do not want to be on any kind of government register of any kind. They don't want to come forward to healthcare providers. They just want to stay under the radar. So they're not getting tested. No. So we're in a situation where we have no idea what we're dealing with, and so it's very hard to make plans to respond.
So I want to move on because we have a limited amount of time. I want to go back to you, Jackie, talking more about the JWST telescope has been very busy this year. You talked about this brown dwarf, but what about this exoplanet that you discovered? Really cold?
Yeah, really cold. Right.
How cold is it?
How cold is it? Well, I'm going to tell you the value, but it's not how cold it is. It's how cold it is, and we could detect it directly. There's about 5,000 planets that we know orbit other stars, not our star. We have eight planets in our own solar system, right? We're good? Just leaving Pluto out of it. I know. I heard it. Somebody said, oh, I get it. It's hard. But forget it. I'm not talking about that. But outside of the solar system, there's about 5,000 we've discovered. More than 70% of those were detected because we looked at the star and we saw the star do something that indicated there was a planet around it. It doesn't mean we saw the planet. It means we saw the influence of the planet on the star. And so more than 70% of them have been found through these other methods. And there was one that was discovered. We knew it was there around a star called Epsilon Indi. It's in this constellation called Indus. It's a cool constellation. You can actually see the star with your naked eye. If you go outside, not in New York City, you might be able to catch it. Okay. I'll encourage you to do that. You have to go south, though. So it's a star that's a little bit less massive than our own sun. And this result is what I call a Hail Mary attempt by the James Webb Space Telescope. We were trying to see how we could use the James Webb Space Telescope to directly detect, not the other thing I just told you about how we see the influence that the planet has on the star, but to actually see the planet. And so James Webb was used to try and find. We knew it was there because we had used a different method to say, no, 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 it's doing something to the star. We know it's there. And then we looked and we saw it. And so are you ready for the temperature?
I'm ready.
280 degrees Kelvin.
That's which is pretty chilly.
It's a balmy day. It's a balmy day at the North Pole. I have to say it in Kelvin because that's how my brain was thinking right now, and I didn't want to do a wrong conversion for you. So I said it in Kelvin. But it's just think of it. It's like a cold day at the North Pole. It's actually, Ira, it's not that much colder than the object I first told you about. It's a kind of a brown dwarf temperature. So it's cold. It's more like a Jupiter. It's a Jupiter-like planet.
Wow.
But we saw it.
So it's giving off some amount of heat that you can detect it.
That's right. So the light that we get from it is because they're big enough that they're still actually radiating away the energy from when they formed.
That is amazing.
It's good. Wow. It's a good result.
It's a good, yeah. You know, I love talking about all this kind of stuff. So I want to talk to Kevin a little bit because we talk peripherally about AI and how it's entered all of our lives. It's changing technology with health and with art. And what about climate change? How is AI impacting our discussion of it, our use of it?
Yeah, well, it's evolving fast. There was a report that came out in the journal Nature from Google that they've developed a new AI tool that can forecast the weather out to 15 days. Right. So your favorite weather app, it can go out to 15 days and it can do so with a skill that's better than the state of the art right now, which is the European Center's forecast. And they're doing this in a fraction of the computational cost that it takes to run an operational model. And that's just one example. And so the potential of artificial intelligence to replace a lot of the conventional tools we use to do science and to do forecasting, both of weather and of climate, is really immense. There's this really important, I think, application of AI that we're going to start to see more and more of in the coming years, and that we've started to see already just this year, which is most climate and climate change occurs at first at a global level, right? But we live right here, and our home is at a specific address, right, in a certain part. And we're often curious about, well, will my house flood?
Hyperlocal. Right?
Yes, hyperlocal. Yeah, that whatever that means, right? Right. And AI offers the potential to run through that gamut of models that gets you from a climate model, which is very large scale, right, to a regional model, to a hydraulic model, to a flooding model, to a damage model. And if you can actually use AI to train to go across that kind of sweep, it's allow us to actually take climate information and get it at that quote unquote hyper local level. And I think that that's going to be a huge opportunity for us to really understand the physical risk of climate change and to actually really understand the implications of the different types of solutions that we might want to use for adaptation and resilience. However, just like everything, there's no free lunch, yeah. Right? As we've kind of already alluded to already with the discussion around Microsoft, these data centers that often are used for a lot of these AI algorithms are very, very expensive, and they actually require a lot of energy. And where is that energy mostly coming from? Well, it's coming from the electric grid. And so that also means that in the current setup, as we build new data centers for AI applications, it actually can increase the amount of carbon dioxide that's emitted into the atmosphere. Of course, as our grid becomes more renewable, that will become less of a challenge. But in these kind of next 2, 3, 5, 10 years, there's a real potential that there can actually be an impact of these applications on the amount of emissions. And once, and if we haven't talked about it before, once carbon dioxide's up in the atmosphere, it stays up there for a couple hundred years, right?
A couple hundred years.
It's important that we start to think about that when we start to scale up these applications for climate.
We need to take a break, and when we come back, the role of AI in public health, areas for collaboration between the sciences, and some stories to keep an eye on in the coming year. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. In case you're just joining us, it's our Year in Review event held earlier this month at WNYC's Green Space in New York with astrophysicist Jackie Faherty, climate scientist Kevin Reed, and public health expert Celine Gounder. We were talking about the effects of AI on the panelists' fields. Celine, let's think about AI and how it affects your work as an epidemiologist and a public health person.
I think the impact of AI is going to be more limited for a few reasons. One is you need to train your AI on data. And data in the public health world is highly siloed. I think this is one thing that people still don't understand after, you know, coming out of the COVID pandemic, is that most of your public health powers are at the state and or local level. And so they each own the data. And so how much will they share? This is a huge problem we had in terms of data feeding up to the CDC, data feeding up from local jurisdictions and state health departments, getting data from healthcare systems. And so when the data is so siloed and you're not able to piece it together on which to train your AI, you have limitations. There are some amazing new advancements that could potentially feed into AI systems, like what we call metagenomics, where you take a sample of, let's say, sewage, and you could sequence everything in that sewage and know what are all the viruses and bacteria and parasites and so on. Imagine if we were doing that all over the world. And so you could, using that, do surveillance, combine that with other kinds of surveillance, like what we call syndromic surveillance, which is where you're looking for people with certain symptoms, like flu-like symptoms, coming into the ER. You could combine that with other kinds of reporting, what's coming out of labs who are diagnosing those patients, et cetera. But if those data sets remain siloed and we're not able to train AI across those data sets, that will limit what the impact can be.
You all have spoken a bit about your areas of scientific research and what can be done more by working better together with other industries. Let's start with you, Celine. What areas of scientific research do you hope to see more collaboration with in 2025?
So there are a few, and then they relate to some of the things I talked about before. I think, well, climate change and public health, for sure. I think climate change is going to be one of the big drivers of many public health issues in the future. A lot of the pandemics that we've seen over the years, whether that's Ebola related to deforestation and increasing human contact with wildlife, COVID, actually some of the same factors, we will see more infectious diseases emerge. We will see the spread of dengue, for example, and other mosquito-borne diseases. So I do think there needs to be huge collaboration with folks working in climate change, air quality, water quality, or some other ones, heat waves and the impact on health. Another one would be, as I was talking about, those papers on the Human Development Index and health and income and education. These things are really intertwined. And we need to be studying these things in collaboration with our colleagues in those spaces.
Right.
And then finally, the other area is around political polarization and how can we reinstill trust in science? How do we depoliticize some of these things that really should not be political issues?
And Jackie, what about astronomy and astrophysics? Are there collaboration ideas here that we'll see more of in the future?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's happening in astronomy is in when you're using a telescope like the James Webb Space Telescope and you're looking for molecules and you're trying to figure out phenomenon, it ends up needing cross-collaboration with other sciences that we do collaborate with, but not enough. And what I see as important are chemists. There's a lot of things that we discover that we're like, oh, I've never seen the molecule act that way. We actually need more things that happen on Earth where you get your chemist friends to gear up their labs where they have these like very, very complex ways to get to different pressures and temperatures of a given molecule and they can actually see what it might be doing. That does happen in geologic departments. And so geology, I think, needs to collaborate more with astronomy. I'd really like to see more cosmochemistry. So crossing between chemistry and astronomy right now, specifically, since this is a year in review show, I would say I would like to see that happen for 2025 next year.
All right, let's go to the audience. Who's got the microphone? And let's begin right over here.
So, Jackie, I think Ira hit the other two panelists with the AI question. I wonder, since you were a downer on AI earlier in your
I wasn't a downer.
I know.
I got misinterpreted. But go ahead.
Yeah, so I think, I mean, obviously, machine learning has been in astrophysics and physics for since the beginning of time. I mean, do you see something as a quantum improvement in terms of your field regarding the application of AI in the coming years?
Yeah, what I was saying is that I use both techniques. I brought up citizen scientists, and it's in part because I often get asked, why are you using people to do a job you could actually set AI onto? And what I was saying, and I think this is across the fields, and I have listened to a lot of AI talks, AI does not replace everything that humans do. Mm-hmm. It's not good enough yet at it. And that is very true in astrophysics, that we do not, we have used it. We've used it with differing levels of success in order to discover new things, to classify new things. So what I was just referring to as the human eye is still amazing at doing astronomy. We are very far from being replaced. But in the next year, there's a telescope coming online. It's called Rubin Observatory, named after the great, amazing Vera Rubin. And what that is going to do is it's going to image the sky as seen from the southern hemisphere from Chile. It's going to image it every 3 nights, the whole of the sky that you could see. It is a fire hose of data that's going to come in. And I'm not kidding. It is. Astronomers are worried about the data volume. Right. And so the conversation right now is heightened amongst us astronomers about how we're going to use machine learning and AI tools to parse that data, make discoveries quick so we can follow them up. Because we're going to start to see what's called the transient universe at a level we have never had access to before. So for 2025, you will start seeing far more results, I think, with this telescope coming online, because that kind of data set demands these kinds of tools.
That is really cool. Okay, another question. Yes, over here.
First, which do you think is worse, 1918 flu or fully adapted bird flu?
It's very difficult to be making those comparisons. When we've seen H5N1 overseas, it's had a 30 to 50% case fatality rate. Wow. COVID ended up having a less than 1% case fatality rate, and we still had over 1 million people die in this country. Fortunately, what we've seen in this country with the H5N1 bird flu cases so far, they have been relatively mild, with the exception of that one case in Canada, in British Columbia. Right now, we're crossing our fingers that it stays that way, but that's not, crossing your fingers is not a really good plan.
Yeah. Next question over there.
So you've been talking a lot about like AI advances and like space technology, but like I'm wondering about the human advances, because it's been a long time since we've had like a really big step in like humans visiting outer space or something like another step like visiting the moon or something like that, and we haven't really had like anything big about that.
Jackie?
Yeah, well, it's coming soon, very soon. You look young, I think. You look like you may be a part of the next generation. We are also very young on this stage, and maybe we'll go. Yeah. I should not have insulted us. So there's a mission called Artemis, which NASA is slating for the next time that we will be sending people to the moon. We have not sent anybody to the moon since the 70s. But what I would say is that it's coming very soon. So NASA has made a promise, and it's not just NASA. It is political. It does have to do with administrations, at what funding we will go to send people. But there is a commitment with Artemis to send the first female to step foot on the moon, or the first person of color to step on the moon, or both, or whichever we can get to in terms of a diverse population of people, because the only people that have stepped on the moon are 12 different men. And that's one of the commitments that's coming, and it is definitely coming in our lifetimes in the next 2 to 3 years. We will be stepping on the moon, not Mars, thank you. Elon Musk wants to, but that does not mean that we will get there. You will die because of radiation. That's it.
As I said before, I hate it when that happens. Yes, go ahead. Go ahead.
I love that two young people just spoke. I'm an educator. What should I be focusing on? What do I need to teach?
Ooh, to all our panelists, anybody in particular?
Well,
everybody.
I'll actually go ahead and start, which is, you know, I think... when it comes to climate and climate impacts, right, that I think that right now the sooner we start teaching that, the sooner we engage the public around what does climate change mean for you, right?
But Kevin, are the teachers equipped to teach that?
Yes and no. So I think that the city of New York has been starting to build a little bit of curriculum around this and have started to build sustainability programs right into some of the schools. But I think we can do more, to your point, Ira, in the sense that if you can teach geology, right, and the sciences that are also taught in elementary and middle and high school, you can also start to teach more of the climate aspects of that. But it's not just about teaching the science of it. It's teaching, you know, how can you be a part of the solution, right? What does it mean for you? How can you reduce your carbon impact, but while also holding those that are having the majority of the carbon emissions accountable?
Yeah, I would just add teaching the scientific method.
Yeah.
This is not an intuitive way of thinking. The intuitive way of thinking is much more lawyerly, which is you already have your conclusion. How can I prove that? The scientific method is you have a hypothesis, you design experiments to disprove your hypothesis, and then you continue to experiment, you repeat, you change the conditions, and slowly over time you build knowledge. But that is not an intuitive way of thinking, and I think a lot of students, unfortunately, do not come out of their educations with that kind of critical thinking skill.
I think we have time for one more question from the audience. Who's got right here.
Is there a way that all three of your fields could come together for the benefit of the future and science and work together to, like, benefit humanity?
I think yes.
Yeah.
Wow. I always say that the youngest folks in the audience ask the most difficult questions.
We're going to find a planet that does not have climate change and no disease exists because the atmosphere has these molecules in it that destroy disease, and its atmosphere doesn't want to have climate change, so it's not going to have it.
Well, in a slightly different approach.
That was the comedy approach.
You know, the majority of our observations now of the climate system actually come from space, right? And actually just this year was one of the advances of that, is now we can actually globally measure by NASA satellites carbon dioxide, where it is in the atmosphere and where it's going. And so I think that's a natural aspect, that as we continue to build out technology to have higher data coming in, whether we're looking out at space or we're going to space and looking back at our Earth, allows us to better understand the interconnectedness of the climate system, which then, of course, connects to the impacts on humans that live there, and uses a lot of that same technology that's being used also to look out further out to space to learn about what's out there and exoplanets and all those type of things. Mm-hmm. So maybe that would be my other approach.
All right. Well, as we wind up and run out of time, Celine, I want to ask you, what stories are you going to be following in 2025?
Well, I'm going to be following what's going to be happening under the new administration. We've seen a number of nominees within HHS. What will that mean for science? What will that mean for science at the NIH? What will that mean for science at the CDC? And it's not just those two agencies, which probably fund the bulk of the medical science in this country and public health science in this country, but also people's trust in science, again, will have everything to do with whether they feel like they're benefiting from that science. And so we've access to GLP-1 drugs, the weight loss drugs. The Biden administration just announced that Medicare will be expanding coverage, not just on the basis of having diabetes, but also obesity, period. You don't have to have another condition. But that rule will not be finalized until President-elect Trump is in office. Will he follow through on that? What will that mean? What will that mean for Medicare spending? What will that mean for other things that we're trying to cover people for? So, you know, I think there's a lot that remains to be seen as to how this will play out. But if people don't feel like they're benefiting from the advancements, they won't trust us.
Yeah. And Jackie, what about you? What's going to be happening in astronomy, astrophysics? You mentioned the Rubin Observatory. What will that allow us to see with the new observatory?
I mentioned the Rubin Observatory. It's getting its first light as we speak. It's a ground-based telescope. It's on Earth. It's a big telescope, and it has the largest camera that we have ever built. So that's why it can see the sky every three nights. And what it opens up for us is everything is changing in the universe. Everything is changing at every second. We're going to find things like it's going to help us with asteroids. That's a problem. I can say bad things too. Like the asteroids could hit us and we will look for that. And the Rubin Observatory is well slated to detecting near-Earth hazardous asteroids. It's also very good at detecting things that blow up. Don't worry, that's fine for you all. That's not going to hurt you. It's just stars are always exploding, not just in our own galaxy. We actually haven't had one in a while, and so we're kind of waiting for that to happen for us. But every galaxy's got these stars that are massive and blow up, and it is just going to showcase it for us. Look out for that. It's going to be really exciting in 2025.
I can always find the dark cloud in your silver lining. What about funding for these projects? So could we expect that funding might be cut under a new administration?
Well, that telescope I just mentioned is the largest investment in a telescope by the National Science Foundation.
Funded by the U.S. government.
Funded by the U.S. government. And it's funded. So it's completed. They can't take it away. But funding the science is a critical thing that needs to keep happening because, yes, that telescope can have data. But the thing that we're all a little bit concerned about is funding the scientists that want to work on the data, paying for the grad students and the postdocs and the undergrads. Mm-hmm. That's a fear that while you can produce all the data that you want, but we thrive, astronomers, other fields too, we need government funding in order to do the science on the instruments that the government has paid for us to have.
Let me ask my other panelists, do you find that there are enough scientists who might be coming into the government who can understand how to spend that kind of money? Celine?
I am concerned about a brain drain right now. There are a lot of people who are really nervous about what the incoming administration will do, what it will mean for their environment in which they do research. There's also something called Schedule F, of federal employees, where normally there are certain civil service protections. The prior Trump administration made some of these changes to make it easier to eliminate positions. The Biden administration reversed that. The incoming administration is planning to reinstitute the Schedule F. And so that is a way of getting rid of a lot of career scientists and putting in political appointees, which we've seen at the top levels now. So that is very concerning, particularly when we have been the leaders in much, you know, the scientific world. You know, now you have China and others that are catching up and perhaps succeeding us in certain spaces. But it is really concerning what might happen.
Well, I want to thank all of you. We have run out of time for such an eclectic discussion and a wide-ranging discussion. Thank you all for joining us. Celine Gounder, Senior Fellow and Editor-at-Large for Public Health at KFF Health News. Jackie Faraday, astrophysicist and brown dwarf researcher at the American Museum of Natural History. And Kevin Reed, Chief Climate Scientist at the New York Climate Exchange and Associate Provost for Climate and Sustainability Programming at Stony Brook University. Great job, everybody. And that's it for this hour. Thanks to all the folks who came out to join us at WNYC's Green Space, and to everyone who helped put that event together. BJ Liederman composed our theme music. If you missed any part of the program or you'd like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts. You can reach out to us on email. Our address is scifry@sciencefriday.com. Wishing you a peaceful holiday and happy new year. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Hoping you're having a peaceful holiday season. Coming up, a look back at some of the biggest science news of the last year. We're also celebrating our 33rd anniversary. Yeah, it's been that long. And earlier this year, we asked you to vote on some of your favorite sci-fi segments for the past three decades. And many of you wanted to hear from primatologist and researcher Jane Goodall once again. She's been on our program a number of times over the years, but we wanted to feature this conversation from 2002. That year, she'd been named the United Nations Messenger of Peace. She was also featured that year in a documentary called Jane Goodall's Wild Chimpanzees. And she just finished a book called The Ten Trusts, What We Must Do for the Animals We Love. So here again is Dr. Jane Goodall, who joined us in our New York studios. Have a listen.
Thank you very much for coming in to join us today, Dr. Goodall.
Thanks for inviting me.
What is a United Nations Messenger of Peace? You're very proud of that, I know.
Well, I feel it's a great responsibility. There are nine of us, appointed by Kofi Annan, the Secretary General himself. And I think he appointed me because I was explaining to him about our youth program, Roots and Shoots, which is involving young people in 60 countries in hands-on projects to make this world a better place for animals, people, and the environment that we share. And it's very much about breaking down barriers that we erect between people of different ethnic groups, cultures, religions, between young people of different countries. And so in a way, I explained to him that I was going around the world anyway, sowing seeds of global peace in the minds of young people. And he loved that image. And I think this is why he asked me if I would take on the additional job of just talking about some of the UN initiatives for peace.
So is this going to be the next part of your career, do you think? Have you moved away from research on the chimps now and in this heading in this new direction?
Well, I haven't been involved in the actual research since 1986, when I suddenly realized that chimpanzees were vanishing in the wild and being horribly mistreated in captivity. That was during a conference in Chicago when we brought all the chimp people from around Africa together. The research at Gombe continues. There's a great team there. But my role, you know, other than occasionally visiting just really for my own good, is to be sure that the money is there to ensure that the research continues and continues in the right way.
Let's talk a little bit about your background. Gilbert Grosvenor, chairman of the National Geographic Society, once wrote about you in one of your books. She was hardly the image one would project to become an old African hand. Her bush experiences were honed in the genteel English countryside. How did you wind up with that background in Africa?
Well, it wasn't exactly genteel. I wouldn't have described it like that. But, you know, animals were my passion from even before I could speak, apparently.
And is that right?
So I was watching earthworms in my bed when I was 1.5. And I hid for 5 hours in a hen house when we had the opportunity to go into the country because we lived in the town. And I hid for 5 hours because I was collecting the eggs. And, you know, there was the egg. Where was the hole big enough for the egg to come out? Nobody told me, so I hid.
you wanted to watch it.
And I watched it. And it was my first, you know, wonderful experiment. And then when I was about 10, 11, I found the books about Tarzan of the Apes. No TV in those days, so I read the books. Mm-hmm. Fell in love with Tarzan. He's got that wife, Jane, you know, so I was terribly jealous of her. And that was when my dream started. When I grew up, I would go to Africa, live with animals, and write books about them. That's how it all began.
And how did you fulfill that dream?
Well, I got the opportunity when a school friend invited me to go and stay on their farm in Kenya, where her parents had just bought some land. And I was working at the time with Documentary Film Studio in London, which is a great job, didn't pay very much. So I quit that, went home, and worked as a waitress and served people there breakfast, lunch, tea, and dinner until I'd saved up enough money to buy my return fare by boat because it was cheapest in those days. So, you know, I was 23 and I sort of said bye-bye to family, friends, and country, and off I went on this amazing adventure.
And so somebody invited you to go or did you just show up on the doorstep someplace?
No, this was a school friend.
School friend.
And I went to stay there, but, you know, I was taught that you didn't sponge on people for too long. So I stayed there for a month. But we had arranged a job for me in Nairobi, a boring job, a secretarial job, but at least I would be independent. And that was when I heard about the late Louis Leakey. And somebody said, Jane, if you're interested in animals, you must meet Louis. So I picked up the telephone, cheeky me, and made an appointment to go and see Louis Leakey. He was then curator of the Natural History Museum in Nairobi.
He was a wonderful gentleman, wasn't he?
He was amazing.
Tell us some Louis Leakey stories.
Well, you know, the first time when I called, to my amazement, he answered the phone and he said, I'm Leakey, what do you want? Which wasn't a very auspicious beginning. But then when I got there, he took me all around. He asked me so many questions about the animals there. And because I had done what my mother said I should do, which was, you know, if you really want something, you work hard, you take advantage of opportunity, and you never give up. Mm-hmm. I'd been reading about Africa. I'd spent all my lunch hours in the Natural History Museum in London learning about Africa and animals. So I think he was impressed, and he gave me the opportunity to work for him. And he took me with his wife and one other young English girl to, at that time, they did 3 months in the summer at the now famous Olduvai Gorge. But that was before any human remains were found.
Right.
So it was absolutely wild, untouched Africa. And typical Lewis, there was never any money, so everything was on a shoestring. And the equipment mostly didn't work. And it was a very ramshackle sort of place. And I remember when he first talked to me about going on that expedition, which was, you know, I had all my fingers crossed. And he said, well, it's going to depend on my wife. If she likes you, you can come. And can you imagine what it was like when I went to lunch at the house thinking, oh, dear, what can I do to make Mary like me?
Obviously, she did.
Fortunately, she did, yes.
And were you around then when we made that famous discovery?
No, I was the year before.
It was the year before. Oh, just missed it.
Which was so lucky.
It was
lucky. Yes, because it was absolutely unknown. We just spent all day chipping away in the rock. There wasn't a road there. There wasn't a trail. There was nothing. And all the animals were there, the antelopes, the zebra, the giraffes. And then one evening there was a rhino, which was a little bit scary. And one evening, a young male lion, 2 years old, totally curious. And he followed us for at least, well, a couple of football pitches, I should say.
Well, you sound like you were bitten by the bug right there.
Before I even got there, and when I got out to Olduvai, it was like being at home.
And so then how did you find your way toward working with the chimps?
Well, it was during that Olduvai time that Lewis realized that I was the sort of person he said he'd been looking for about 10 years, who didn't care about hairdressing and clothes and parties and boyfriends. You know, I really wanted to be in the wild. It took him a year to get the money. I mean, who was going to give money to a young girl, a female, who didn't have a degree of any sort, straight out from England? I mean, what a ridiculous idea. So I was in England waiting, learning what I could about chimpanzees while he searched for money and eventually found a wealthy American businessman. And said, okay, Lewis, here you are. Here's enough money for 6 months. We'll see how she does.
And you did pretty well.
Well, it was a very, very worrying time because I got to Gombe. Again, I felt I was at home. But the chimpanzees ran away as soon as they saw me. You know, they're very conservative. They'd not seen a white ape before. And I knew if that 6 months' money ran out before I'd seen something really exciting, everyone would, you know, I would have let Lewis down. Well, we told you so. This is ridiculous. But fortunately, just before that time came, I saw the first observations of using and making tools, and that was the saving observation, the breakthrough. And he was able to go to the National Geographic Society and persuade them to put some more money in when the first 6 months ran out. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, at that time, you know, we were defined as man the toolmaker. That right. was supposed to differentiate us more than anything else from the rest of the animal kingdom.
And you discovered that even the chimps could make tools.
David Greybeard, bless his heart. I saw him crouched over a termite mound. Couldn't really see properly. They were still not very relaxed in my presence. I was hiding, but I knew he was using a piece of grass. And a few days later, he and one of the other chimps, I could see them much better. The whole thing, putting in the grass, picking the termites off, picking a leafy twig and stripping off the leaves, which is the beginning of tool making. So that was it.
Exciting?
It was. I couldn't actually believe it. I had to see it about 4 times before I let Lewis Leakey know. And then I sent a telegram. You know, we're pre-fax era back then. And he sent back his famous comment, ha-ha, now we must redefine man, redefine tool, or accept chimpanzees as humans.
Incredible. And interesting, you talked about the name of the chimp that you had. I guess no one else was doing any of this stuff at that time. You were, I mean, in terms of naming chimps, was that something that other scientists were doing, giving names to their chimps?
No, they weren't. And the funny thing was, you know, after a bit, Lewis said, he said, Jane, you have to get a degree because otherwise you can't get your own money and I won't always be around to get money for you. But he said, we don't have time to mess about with a BA, so you'll have to go straight for a PhD. So he managed to persuade Cambridge in England to accept me as a PhD student. And when I got there, it was actually a very unpleasant and hostile reception that I had. I shouldn't have named the chimps. It wasn't scientific. I didn't know. I mean, I knew nothing. I couldn't talk about their personalities, these vivid personalities that I by then was beginning to know. I certainly couldn't talk about them being capable of rational thought, which they clearly were. And finally, worst sin of all, was that I was ascribing to them emotions like happiness, sadness, and so forth. But fortunately, one, by that time I was 27, and, you know, I wasn't in it because I wanted a PhD. I was there for Lewis. But more importantly, perhaps, all through my childhood, I had this wonderful teacher, and that was my dog, Rusty. So I knew that animals had personalities, minds, and feelings, and of course they needed names.
That's Dr. Jane Goodall speaking to me in 2002. Coming up, we'll hear one of our favorite moments on the show, her impersonation of chimpanzee calls. You're going to want to hear that, so stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're celebrating our 33rd anniversary with some of your favorite interviews from the Sci-Fi Archives. And today we're listening to my 2002 conversation with primatologist Jane Goodall.
And when you saw the chimp taking the ants out on the stem, how did you know that was an important thing? How did you know? You had no training, right?
I knew because just about 2 weeks before that, I was visited by George Schaller, who just finished his mountain gorilla study. And as we sat up on the peak, which was my lookout place, from which gradually the chimps got used to me, he said, if you see tool using and hunting, those two things will make your study worthwhile. And within 2 weeks, I saw them both. It was quite extraordinary. And both times it was David Greybeard.
The same one.
The same one.
How long did he live for?
David Greybeard died in 68. There was an epidemic of some kind of pneumonia. And he wasn't very old. He must have been about maybe 35 when he died, something like that.
And how long should a chimp live till?
They can live to be 60. Now, Fifi, who was a little baby when I arrived in 1960, she's about 43 now, and she looks absolutely fine. In fact, she's pregnant again and could have a baby this month.
Do you say mazel tov to a chimp? I'm not sure. Yeah, I get to say that, I guess. Yeah. That's terrific.
But, you know, they can live to be 60.
Wow. Well, now, I know you do wonderful chimp calls. I'm going to try to get my engineer ready for this because Jane tells me it's pretty loud. So tell us what call you're going to be giving.
Well, I'm going to do the greeting. And it's the kind of sound you'd hear if you went to Gombe and you climbed up onto the ridge in the morning and you listened. And if you're lucky, you hear the chimpanzee who's calling out saying, here I am, it's a wonderful day, where are you? And
wow, that's great. And
each one has his or her own individual voice. So you know exactly who's calling.
So like we can tell on the phone who the chimp is, you can also tell.
Yes, correct.
Do chimps have dialects from different parts also?
They actually do. Now, nobody's done very much work on that, but my ear isn't that good for chimp sounds, but even I can go like to Uganda or into Congo and hear the chimps calling. And although there's a lot that's the same, you do hear different kinds of sounds.
Mm-hmm. I want to pick up on the thread you were talking about before the break about you having to get a PhD. You went back and they were just aghast at you.
Yeah, they were.
Whippersnapper, it's upstart.
Yeah, it was even accused of teaching the chimps how to fish for termites, which, I mean, that would have been such a brilliant coup.
So continue.
Eventually, you know, so the Geographic came in and provided money. And then my late ex-husband was sent out by Geographic, and he got this amazing film, some of which has been blown up for the new IMAX. And it's just amazing that that film that he took in 1961 has blown up onto this huge screen. It's very moving for me to see that. I'm back.
I think that that's how I learned about you when I was young. I think that most people saw those National Geographic specials on television.
Yes, they did. They did. And whole generations of people saw and were moved by those and got fascinated. And, you know, literally thousands of people have said, I'm doing what I do because I grew up with you.
besides your initial discovery, what has been most surprising to you?
The most surprising and shocking, really, was when in 1970, that's after 10 years of research, we realized that chimpanzees have a dark side just like we. I thought they were so like us, but rather nicer. And then to find that they're capable of brutality, that they may even have a series of events not unlike primitive warfare, that they can attack members of another social group so severely that those individuals die as a result of their wounds, and that infants can be killed. And that was very, very shocking.
Mm-hmm. And any why it took 10 years, about 10 years, to discover that?
Well, because the boundary patrols are right out at the far end of their range. And I suppose we just weren't following them far enough. But also the warlike, you know, we called it the four-year war, that was a rather specific circumstance. And it was when our main study community divided and the smaller half took up a portion of the range which they had previously all shared. And when those two groups had sort of completely separated, then the males of the larger group began to systematically annihilate the split-off individuals. So it was almost like a civil war. And it was very, very shocking.
And it almost sounds like it was a thought out. It was a thought out kind of tactic.
Well, they certainly, when they're moving out to the peripheral part of their range, it seems to be planned. Like one or two males will set off and they'll look back. And very soon the entire group knows exactly what's happening. At that point, the females and young ones usually stop and they don't go on with the big males.
Mm-hmm. You've been in the forefront in the last few years. As you say, you gave up real field research in the 80s, late 80s, of animal rights. Tell us about that.
I was very shocked at this conference in Chicago to see secretly filmed footage of chimpanzees in a medical research lab in cages that were 5 foot by 5 foot and totally bleak and barren, isolated, these highly social beings who are so like us in so many ways. And that was really what took me out as an advocate, took me away from pure research. Mm-hmm. Because I felt I owed it to the chimps. They taught me so much. They'd given me so much. They really helped to blur the line that people saw as so sharp, dividing us from the rest of the animal kingdom. And once that line is seen as blurred, once you're prepared to admit that we're not the only beings with personalities, minds, and feelings, then you have a new respect not only for the chimps, the other great apes, but other amazing sentient, sapient beings with whom we share the planet. Mm.
And so do you blanketly believe that no research should be done on any animals?
I think that it all started, it was very unfortunate that there was this feeling that it's fine to do anything to an animal as long as maybe it's for human good. And what I hope for is that we have a new mindset. Instead of saying, as most scientists will, unfortunately, we'll always need some animals. But, you know, you have to realize that so many protocols that people used to say, we always have to have animals, we've already got alternatives to those. Mm-hmm. And so I want a mindset that says, it's not really ethical to do this to animals. So let's get together as soon as we can and find ways to do it without using animals. Because, you know, our brains are so amazing. We can do so much.
Let's go to Sharif in Philadelphia. Hi.
How are you doing? It's a pleasure to speak with you. I wanted to know if you believe there are any undiscovered large ape species.
You're talking about Yeti or Bigfoot or Sasquatch.
Is that what he's talking about?
Yes, he is.
is that the message I'm missing here?
I think that's the message you're missing.
Is that right, Sharif?
Pretty much.
I'm out of the loop. Go ahead.
Well, now you'll be amazed when I tell you that I'm sure that they exist.
You are?
Yeah. I've talked to so many Native Americans who've all described the same sounds, two who've seen them. I've probably got about 30 books that have come from different parts of the world, from China, from all over the place. And there was a little tiny snippet in the newspaper just last week, which says that British scientists have found what they believe to be a Yeti hare, and that the scientists in the Natural History Museum in London couldn't identify it as any known animal. Now, that was just a wee bit in the newspaper, and obviously we have to hear a little bit more about that.
Well, this age of DNA, if you find a hair, there might be some cells on it.
Right? Well, there will be, and I'm sure that's what they've examined, and they don't match up. What this my little tiny snippet said, that don't match up with DNA cells from known animals, so apes.
Did you always have this belief that they existed?
Well, I'm a romantic, so I always wanted them to exist.
All right, Sherry.
Thank you.
You're quoted in a news story saying that the fight against terrorism is threatening to overshadow environmental concerns.
Well, it has. Yeah. It does. I mean, look at the drilling for oil in the Alaskan Wildlife Refuge. Now it was blocked, but now probably it's going to be going ahead this week, although in somewhat modified form. But directly after the 11th of September, it was very clear to me as I traveled around the country that people were reluctant to admit that they cared about the environment in case they would seem unpatriotic. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, people are coming out of that mindset because, you know, if we let the planet continue to deteriorate, we really are in a very, very bad state. And if we continue to let that happen, then the terrorists finally will win because for our great-grandchildren, there'll be nothing left.
So do you see yourself as an effective spokesperson for the environment now? There are so few people who are, you know...
Well, I think the effectiveness, you know, I do spend a lot of time talking to young people, but also people from, you know, all walks of life and all ages. Mm-hmm. And one of the remarks that's so often said to me after a lecture, people come up and they say, you have re-inspired me to do my bit. You have made me feel that my own life is more worthwhile. I feel that I've been just sitting doing nothing. Now I want to do what I can. And, you know, that's if we can get enough people thinking that way, if mm-hmm. we can get enough people who care to elect into power the people who also care. But politicians want to be reelected. So until there's a groundswell of people prepared to accept the tough decisions that may affect their purse to some extent, then we'll never get the right legislation.
Do you think that people who might be tougher to reach with that message might be more inclined to invite a Jane Goodall to speak or listen to you as someone who was a quote-unquote a political environmentalist from a mainstream organization, maybe like Greenpeace?
Well, I do know that when talking to people who perhaps think very differently, the only chance you have of getting them to think in a different way is to touch the heart. And if you're strident, if you start accusing people, if you point fingers, then you immediately see the eyes glaze over and you know that you're not getting across. And, you know, I have to go around and think that so much of what goes on that, in my view anyway, is a mistake, is due not to any kind of criminal intent, but simply because people honestly haven't understood. So I feel that that's my job. My job is to help people understand and to think about the future. I mean, if just imagine what this world would be like if we went back to the old tradition of the Native Americans who said every major decision has to be made with the question, how will this affect our people 7 generations on? Even if we could just say 2 generations on, even 1 generation on, it would be helpful.
Yeah, with corporate and political frameworks working to the next quarter.
Yeah, a quick buck now and, you know, the hell with the consequences.
Yeah. Do you miss, though, the forest? Do you miss going back to the forest?
I try and keep the forest in me. That's what I have to do to remain sane. But when I do go back to Gombe, you know, it's to be out in the forest, even without a chimpanzee, to be in that timeless world where it's soft and where life is entwined and you actually see the pattern of nature. And I always feel this great spiritual power, which I believe is around.
It must rejuvenate you.
It does, absolutely.
You get to see what you're fighting for.
Yes, and you know, just recently I was with Mike Fay. I don't know if you remember Mike Fay walked 2,000 miles across the Congo Basin to see what was there and raise awareness. And I went with him into the Guelogo Forest, which is a 25-kilometer walk, which for somebody used to hotel corridors and airports is quite a walk. But it was magic. Nobody's ever lived there, not even the pygmies, because it's surrounded by swamps. And the chimpanzees and gorillas haven't learned to be afraid. And it was just, it was such a magical experience. It was only 5 days. But, you know, that will keep me going for a very long time.
What about this idea of ecotourism, which Costa Rica has been successful with?
Yes,
other
I was just in Costa Rica. Mm-hmm. Because the wonderful thing about Costa Rica is that they have money for the environment and social issues because they got rid of their army. They have no military budget. It's so magical. I was just there talking with President Pacheco and, you know, out in the forest. And we're now involved in the forest in Costa Rica. And I think ecotourism, if it's done right, is definitely something that has to be. It has to be. We have to let people see for themselves this magic world so that they feel in their heart the importance of preserving it. And that's one of the things that I hope the IMAX will do.
What do you want to be remembered for? Would you rather be remembered for discovering the tool-making abilities of the chimps or for your work in the environment today?
I think I'd like to be remembered as someone who really helped people to have a little humility and realize that we are part of the animal kingdom, not separated from it. That has done a lot. The various results from chimpanzee research has done a lot to soften scientific attitude. So I think I'd like to be remembered for that. And then about my work for the environment, let's wait till I'm dead and see what sort of impact I've had, and then I can tell you.
we're not looking forward to finding out.
But I do think the Roots and Shoots program for youth, that's something that I believe is tremendously important.
Tell us a little bit more about that. What is that?
It started in Tanzania in 91. It's a symbolic name. Roots make a firm foundation. Shoots seem tiny. Together they can break a brick wall. The brick wall, all the problems we've inflicted on the planet, everything, environmental, social, war, terrorism, mm-hmm. hope. Hundreds and thousands of young people around the world can break through. So our programs, which are hands-on actions to make the world better for animals, people, environment, locally, we're now in 60 countries. And we range from preschool through university. It's growing really fast. We've got about 4,000 active groups around the world. The span of what's done is as broad as the imagination of youth, which is huge. And the most important message is that every individual makes a difference every day, and we have this huge power. And if we show it collectively, we can change the world.
That's Jane Goodall, recorded in 2002. It's one of the interviews you voted as one of the best of Science Friday for our 33rd anniversary. Coming back, we'll look back at some of this year's top science stories right after this short break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. For the rest of the hour, we're going to take a look back at some of the biggest science news stories of the year, and it was a very busy one indeed. I recently sat down on stage for a year in review celebration at WNYC's Green Space in New York and talked with two of our show's producers who've been covering these stories for you. Let me welcome them, Charles Berquist, Science Friday's director, senior producer, and our unofficial radio story archivist. Welcome, Charles.
Hey, Ira.
Kathleen Davis, who is our audio producer, State of Science champion, and fill-in host. When I'm not there, she does a great job. Kathleen, welcome.
There.
Nice to have you.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so I'll just start going down the row this way with you, Kathleen. Let's start with that story that many of our listeners may have experienced themselves, this April's total solar eclipse.
Yes, April 8th was a big day for a lot of us. North America was really lucky. We experienced this total solar eclipse. So just a little science reminder, this is when the moon passes between the sun and the earth, and it can block out some of the light. It's also such a great communal event. I love eclipses because you get the little glasses, and everyone is just standing in the street or in a field just looking up.
I spent it in a parking lot out of CVS, and it wasn't working.
No matter where you are, they're a blast.
Yeah.
So more than 30 million people in North America were in the path of totality, and so That included places like Buffalo and Indianapolis, and also down in Texas, a few cities. Even if you weren't in the path of totality, like here in New York City, we had, I think, about 89% coverage, but it's still an amazing event. And so if you did miss this one, you're in luck, because the next total solar eclipse is in August of 2026. And you have time to plan your trip, because apparently the best places to see this will be in Greenland, Iceland, and Spain. So if you ask me, that sounds like the best time to plan a vacation.
I know one out of the three places I will likely go to. Charles, but we did get some less than stellar news from NASA about the Ingenuity Mars helicopter. Tell us what that was.
Yeah, that's right, Ira. I mean, you may recall the nickname was Ginny, but I always thought of this little helicopter as just like this scrappy little guy somehow. And it's really a kind of a reminder of why you shouldn't personify your space robots, because I felt like, you know, I was really sad when it ended, right? Just to remind people, this is a little helicopter that went to Mars, strapped to the bottom of the Perseverance rover, landed in 2021. And it was really small. It was like 4 foot rotor span, I guess you'd say, and weighed about 4 pounds. And the original idea of this was just to be like a demonstration, right? They weren't actually trying to get science out of this. Right. They said, we're going to fly it maybe 5 times over the course of a month, see if we can answer the important question, can you fly a helicopter on Mars? Because the atmosphere is so much thinner than it is here. They really didn't know if it would work. Turns out it did work. And they managed to fly it about 72 times over the course of about 3 years.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, once they figured out that this was working, they said, you know, we can actually use the helicopter to scout out places for the rovers to go,
right,
or, you know, see where in Jezero crater we might want to go next. And they also sort of started testing its limits, right? What if we know that it can fly, can it do this? Can it do this other thing? But then in January of 2024, it had a hard landing during one of its missions, broke a rotor, and that pretty much ended the mission.
I hate when that happens.
Yeah.
You know, but as most things that NASA has sent to Mars, it really outlived its original estimate, right?
Yeah, I mean, you're trying for 5 flights, you get 72. That's not bad.
I'll take that all the time. Charles, back here on Earth, there's been more news and crises related to our drinking water. The EPA finalized the first ever national limits on acceptable PFAS levels in drinking water. And people are still experiencing issues with access to clean water around the country, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think this year really has been one of both increasing awareness of these chemicals, but also increased efforts to try and do something about them.
And PFAS is what?
Yeah, so PFAS stands for perfluoro and polyfluoral alkyl substances.
Very good.
Which basically means you've got a long chain of carbons with a lot of carbon-fluorine bonds along it. And those carbon-fluorine bonds are super strong. They're hard to break. That's part of what made these substances so useful for things like flame retardants and stain repellents. They were used in tons of things for years. But because those bonds are so hard to break, it also means that once those chemicals are made, they stay around in the environment for a long, long time. So now they're in the earth, they're in the water, they're in breast milk, they're in the blood samples of pretty much everybody in this room. And they have been linked to health problems.
Right.
So as you mentioned, in April, the EPA said, we are finally going to put hard limits on 6 of these chemicals that cannot be higher than a certain level in your drinking water. They also said that they're going to give $1 billion to municipalities to help water treatment plants either filter or try and test for these chemicals.
Yeah, that's good news, at least.
It is good news. There's a lot to be done still. A couple of weeks ago, we reported on some researchers who had come up with a new light-activated catalyst that actually can try and break that carbon-fluorine bond that I talked about. It's not ready for prime time yet, but these efforts to try and clean up the PFAS instead of just filtering it out are definitely a good sign.
Charles, you got an A in chemistry, I'm sure.
I did.
College. Catherine, let's talk a little about the advances in healthcare and medicine. The first CRISPR-based therapy was approved by the FDA in the past year. What is that important? What's so important
about it? It's hugely important. I mean, CRISPR is one of the most, I think, amazing medical technologies that we have right now. It is the ability to pinpoint certain genes and modify them while they're still in the body. So at the very tail end of last year, the first CRISPR-based therapies were approved by the FDA. This was a huge step in these therapies. So these were two different therapies that were both for sickle cell disease. So as I think a lot of people know, sickle cell disease is this condition where red blood cells are malformed. It can be incredibly debilitating. It affects about 100,000 Americans in the U.S., most of African descent. And again, it is a very debilitating condition. Mm-hmm. And as I said, there were two gene therapies that both do pretty much the same thing, and they are one-time treatments, which is pretty incredible. The downside is that they're incredibly expensive. They are $2 to $3 million per treatment, which is obviously way outside of the budgets of many people. But this approval is, you know, the first step to get more of these CRISPR-based therapies approved for a general public, and I think that's a huge step.
Yeah, that's good to hear. Let's stay on the health beat a little bit longer, because I know that another story that you've been following is access to abortion care. It's been a really big story again this year. Remind us how access has changed across the country in 2024.
Right. It's hard to talk about medical news without talking about abortion. So as I think we all know, in 2022, Roe versus Wade was struck down. That eliminated the federal constitutional standard for abortion in the U.S. So this became a state's issue. And in many places, it became kind of the Wild West in terms of care. And so there's been a lot of fallout in the last 2 years. OBGYNs that we've had on Science Friday have said that they are moving out of states where abortion has been extremely limited or completely made illegal. One statistic that I always think about is earlier this year, we had a physician on from Idaho where there was a report that said in the last 2 years, almost a quarter of all OBGYNs had left the state.
Because that was amazing. I remember that.
They said they just couldn't ethically do their jobs. And I do think it's important when we talk about this issue that across the board, even, you know, across all political ideologies, support for abortion is actually pretty high. It stands at about 63%.
Yeah. We asked our listeners for some of their most memorable science news stories from the last year. Here's what LA from South Carolina sent us. For me, the biggest science breakthrough this year has to be the approval of weight loss injections by Medicare. I know these things have been around for a while, but when the purse strings opened, my life changed. After 6 months, my health has shown considerable improvement, especially in those systems affected by diabetes. I was demoted to pre-diabetic from hardcore, and at the age of 71, see more possibilities than I did at 61.
Yeah, so. I think this has been one of the biggest science and health stories for a lot of people because it's so personal. These drugs that this listener was talking about include things like Ozempic, Wegovy, they're called GLP-1 agonist medications. And basically what they do is they trigger the release of insulin from the pancreas, and this suppresses the appetite. It increases feelings of fullness. It slows digestion. These drugs are meant to treat conditions like type 2 diabetes, but they're also prescribed in some cases for weight loss. And many people report that these have been incredibly successful for them personally.
Yeah. I bet you there are people in our audience who take it or know somebody who has been taking these drugs. Yeah, it's so widespread. Charles, let's move on to some exciting news from the fossil world. We always cover fossil
stuff. We do. Yeah, I mean, people love fossils, right? But this is a fun one. Researchers exploring the Richards Spur Limestone Cave System. This is a paleontological hotbed in Oklahoma. Found fossilized reptile skin. And what's cool here is it's estimated at 288 million years old, which is 130 million years older than the previous old skin record holder.
Wow. That's a dubious, nice distinction.
I mean, you know,
yeah,
absolutely. You got to strive for something, right?
Yeah.
So they think that because of this, the way the cave system is set up, it's got this really dry environment, it's got these clay sediments, and it's got this oil that sort of seeps through the sediments from even older critters that have broken down. And they think that that's what preserved this sample. They're not big. They're like fingernail size.
The size of the fossils.
The skin samples.
The skin samples, yeah.
Yeah. So they're like fingernail sized. But they say that they can see, it's sort of crocodile-like. You've right. got these sort of disconnected scales that don't overlap. But they say that looking between the scales, they can see these sort of hinge-like structures that are like what you would see in a modern snake or a legless lizard. And the reason that this is sort of significant is that 288 million years ago, this is like, these are some of the first critters to live most of their lives on dry land.
Right.
So you're sort of opening up the whole history of skin formation.
And it's always really fascinating when you could actually have a sample of skin versus just the hard bone.
Right, yeah. They've got both sort of the fossilized skin and also impressions of the skin in other things that give them information about what these critters might actually have looked like.
Yeah, one of our favorite subjects on Science Friday, every time we can talk about it. And Kathleen, I remember one of your favorite stories to report from this year was about an animal closer to home than ancient lizards. Ants.
Exactly.
What could be so exciting about ants?
Well, I'll tell you.
Please.
So, a little bit of context. Back in 2011, scientists were doing a survey of ants in Manhattan, as you do if you are an ant scientist, I suppose.
Sometimes you have no choice in the matter.
Well, yeah. Not a bad place to do ant research, I guess.
Yeah.
And these entomologists found something really interesting. They found a new type of ant that they hadn't seen before in Manhattan. And this was an ant that was fairly large. And side note, the way that these entomologists do this research is, it's just the best. So they basically use a giant straw. They stick it into a flower bed in Times Square, for example.
And I know that flower bed.
They suck up the ants, and they go, not in the mouth, into a container. and then they can do their ant survey. So not my job, but it's somebody's job. So fast forward to this year, in 2024, this ant has dramatically established itself in Manhattan specifically. I'm not joking, off of Broadway. And
no comment necessary.
It's been identified now as Lasius emarginatus, which is actually native to Europe. So the big question now is, okay, how did these little ants not only get to New York, but really establish themselves?
If you've been to Broadway, you know the answer to that.
Well, if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere, absolutely. Is what they say. And so it's too early to know how this is going to affect the ant ecosystem in New York City, but obviously scientists are keeping an eye out for
it. And how do they survive? And I mean, you know, we remember seeing those pictures of the rat carrying the piece of pizza.
Yeah,
what are the ants?
I think urban animals are just very scrappy,
yeah.
And I think those flower beds are pretty warm. But I have to say, the scientists want the public to help in identifying sightings of this ant, especially if you find it outside the city. iNaturalist has a specific page where you can do this, and I have to say, it's not called the Manhattan Project. It's called the Manhattan Ant Project.
The Manhattan. You out-dad-joked me today. And what does it look like, again, if
it
you want
to? It is a fairly large ant. It is dark brown with a reddish midsection. So you might need your special glasses for that one.
Yeah, get your glasses and get out your... Yeah, I love looking for that. Charles, let's close out with our final story for these Sears Roundup. And it's an exciting one. And I'm talking about scientists announced this October that they completed the mapping of the entire brain of a fruit fly.
Yes. I mean,
this is important.
This is very important. This is work looking at something called the connectome, which is basically mapping out the connections between everything in the brain. It's sort of like a wiring diagram for the brain, right? And you say, okay, fruit fly, how complicated can that be? But this is, they ended up mapping the connections between 140,000 different neurons in this teeny little brain, which, you know, connecting back and forth, that works out to like 50 million different linkages.
Wow.
So, you know, this is a huge project. To do this, they took 21 million scanning electron microscope images of fruit fly brains. They gave them to an AI that sort of puzzle pieced them together. But then they combined that data with volunteers who sort of traced the connections, the individual connections.
One at a time.
Yeah. I mean, this is like years worth of person power going into this. And this is sort of key to being able to start to link together which neuron does which behavior. You know, we're going to start with the fruit fly, eventually move to larger animals. But, I mean, to your point, this was in 140,000 neurons. Estimates of human brains is 86 billion neurons.
Wow.
So
yeah,
they got a ways to go.
They got a ways to go. Now, I want to thank you both for filling us in on some great science stories for 2024. Thank you very much.
Thank
Charles
you.
Berkowitz, director and senior producer at Science Friday. Kathleen Davis, producer and fill-in host at Science Friday. And that's about it for this hour. If you missed any part of the program or would like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts or ask your smart speaker to play Science Friday. Have a safe and happy new year. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow.